recent organization that kind of the military concerns of security rub off on it rather easily.
Well, I always felt that, you know, Mars was only to use for unclassified stuff, so why beat yourself up to make it classified compatible?
Well, their plans might have changed. We wouldn't know. We're on the outside looking in. It kind of was a significant thing that Mars, that used to be Army, Navy, I think Marine, Air Force, had to merge together into one organization. That probably does not bode well for its future. So I have no way of knowing whether its purpose has been modified over the years. Or, you know, for the same reason I've been talking about, the secrecy aspect of it all.
I have a quick thought on a different subject, although one I alluded to tangentially.
Okay, I mean, does it veer completely out of the realm of our present discussion, or is it adjacent?
Let me just say, you were talking about improving clarity of SSD reception.
Okay, let her rip.
I have said this on this repeater before. For about 10, 12 years now, we buy, you know, low-band radios with direct digital synthesis. And it's a wonderful thing because all my life, you know, frequency drift has always been, a total pain. Well, with direct digital synthesis, it goes away completely. There is no drift. When your dial says 7200.000, that is what you are receiving or transmitting. And I discovered something kind of by accident when I got my FP-891 with direct digital synthesis. If I'm putting around the single sideband part of the band, and I hear a station that seems to be somewhere around an integer kilohertz, like 7102.0, I will put it on 7102.000. And if he is also on direct digital synthesis, and his dial is 7102.000, I hear him with a clarity I never thought was possible with single sideband. Because now you got rid of all those offset errors of never being able to tune in quite right. At which point, several people jumped down my throat about saying they're never going to be restricted on the low band frequency. And I believe you said, no one's talking about restricting you, it's just giving you an extra option, right?
Yeah, I agree apparently with me. I agree with you. I think that's the future of radio technology. I mean, that's the way my Flex works as well. I haven't really discerned, because I don't know often who's on the other end of, you know, what kind of technology they're using. Just today I was on the 10-meter net, which was very good for DX. I spoke from Washington, the state of Washington, all the way to Poland. But there was this one guy who was just 120 hertz off, and I couldn't cajole him into going on the net frequency, so I had to RIT it over to his. Otherwise, 150 hertz made him sound like a real a baritone. If you could get a zero beat on someone, that's a beautiful thing. We seem to have some noise on on the transmission. Maybe someone pushed the talk button, except that this time I don't hear any typing.
Am I coming through?
Unfortunately not. It's kind of knocking out the repeater since I'm not going through the repeater. I see my waveform, so I'm getting through, but you aren't right now, Ed. Hopefully, it sounds silent now. Now it's making more noise. Oh, well, give it another try, Ed. See what happens.
What frequency is that net?
It is 28.380. It starts at 11 o'clock in the morning, and we usually last until sometime like 12:30 or 1 o'clock. This morning, I kind of ran out of paper, so I shut it down at 12:30. It's a nice little net. We don't really hear from anyone on the other side of the Queens-Nassau line. There seems to be some skip or something going on that I'm not quite sure about, but it's a nice net.
SSBI.
Yes, it's a single sideband net.
Do you have GPS on your radio?
Say again, unfortunately, there's a wee bit noise here.
GPS.
Try one more time.
GPS.
I'm not getting it. It sounds like you're saying DDS. You mean double sideband?
Direct digital
sideband. Yeah, my Flex does that. It has no IF stage. Yeah, that's the problem, that very often I don't really, recognize which other transceivers have that feature as well. And if I was to ask probably 50% of the people who had transceivers that had that feature, they wouldn't kind of understand what I was talking about. So it's an interesting thing, and I might bring it up on future nets and experiment a little bit. And my best experiment on the 10-meter net, and I've mentioned it here before, so I apologize for anyone bored by the story, is it was this guy in Florida, and I had diversity reception at the time. I had a horizontal antenna in my right ear and a vertical antenna reception in my other ear. And it sounded offhand like the signal was fading in and out, but because of the diversity reception, I recognized that what was happening was Faraday rotation, was rotating his polarization angle, and I would hear him in the right ear, that it would go over to the left, that it would go back to the right, and it would go over to the left. And so I understood that if I only had one antenna, it would just sound like a standard fading in, fading out type of thing. Someone out there is annoyed. Well, the situation with being annoyed, the way that I'm hooked into the repeater, you can throw anything at it, and I can talk through it, and I think people can hear it. It screws up everyone else, which is a shame. Anyway, let's kind of trace our tracks back to John, KC2SHO. I don't want to leave him hanging. John, any comments?
Thank you. with you to be at. So with some comments.
Yeah, sure, Frank.
Thanks for your patience. I can't seem to repeat it till it drops, as you know. Separate question for you. But the first thing is when you mentioned the 10-meter net, I was wondering if the polar station and the station in Washington State were able to copy each other, because that would normally be a polar path. Which is not the same path we hear Europe or the West Coast on. Go ahead.
Well, no. I mean, I was doing the net for about an hour and a half, and those two stations were about 20 minutes separated from each other. There was no indication that one heard from the other. It's incredibly common where I have had people, today, I've had people check into the 10-meter net and tell me that my signal was great, and they heard everything that I said, but it sounded like I was well, they didn't say I was insane, but they said that it sounded like I was talking to myself almost, because the skip and what have you, they weren't able to pick up the other people I was talking to. So it's very rare. Occasionally, I have had people, again, today, acted as a relay. There was a gentleman who was a good friend of my other club, the Kings County Radio Club, who had moved to Florida. And for some odd reason, I could not hear him transmitting from Florida. But a station, I think in Nebraska, was able to relay it to me. So, you know, the laws of propagation work in mysterious ways.
Very good. There's a very interesting comment in Ted Cook's ARRL propagation report, which came out last Thursday, I think, where he mentioned that even though the sunspot numbers are spiking way up, propagation is not actually as good as apparently those of us who have experienced the number of sunspot cycles would expect it to be. And that kind of goes along with my observation. I thought it was just me, since I just get on for a couple of minutes at a time using remote sites. And a friend of mine on the West Coast keeps saying propagation has not been all that good, even though he's made some European contacts with 100 watts and a Miracle Whip type antenna on his balcony. You know, I think you may have thought the same thing some days. So it's interesting that Tad Cook made that observation. The propagation just has not been quite as good, even though it's very good for those of us who, you know, tried to keep operating during the sunspot minimum. He did not suggest that the reason for that. I think in another... I forget where, I'm not sure whether it was another one of his reports or Timothy Scott's report. It was probably one of his, since he focuses on radio propagation and she doesn't. He had mentioned that the ozone holes in the polar region may be resulting in, as a result of global warming, may be resulting in less polar propagation this cycle. wondering if you had any thought, or whether there was another propagation guru on this frequency who had any thoughts on that. I mean, the other day I worked Vietnam on 20 meters CW just about our gray line at 5:30. And at that time of day, I've been told, I've heard people say that's mainly a south polar path to Australia, and I guess some of the at Southeast Asia. Go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, AC2GS. We sort of discussed aspects of this over the summer because although 10 meters kind of lit up after last winter, they kind of died for late spring and all of summer. There was absolutely nothing. I was talking, my DX stations were in New Jersey, so there was pretty much nothing to grab onto. And I read some material that discussed that might be gamma ray bursts and others that are disrupting the F1, F2 layers. So that was my understanding, that there were other things coming out of the sun, despite the fact that the solar flux was high and the F1 and F2s were energized. They were being disrupted by something else going on the sun. I don't know if the ozone layer is less than it has been recently. I don't think global warming has an immediate effect on ozone layer. It's more of the reactive gases on refrigerants and other things that interact with it.
Ozone layer is largely real CO2.
Frank, are you still with us?
Yeah, I've been corrected on that. You're right. I have heard that the ozone layer depletion is more related to fluorocarbon pollution than to global warming. And so ozone is a charged ion. I guess that could be affecting the ionosphere. The other interesting comments I've seen in one of the propagation reports was the comment that ionization may be affected by the huge number of LEO satellites, the Starlinks, etc., that are up there creating ion trails. So I'm kind of hard-pressed to think that is sufficient change in ionization to have an impact on what Mother Nature can do. Go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't read anything about that. I mean, the problem with all these theories is that the ozone layer is a lot lower than the ozone layer. The ionosphere and the ozone layer are two different things, so they don't really interact. And the low orbiting satellites are even higher than that. So although they're designated as low Earth orbit, it's still higher up than F1 and F2 layer ever gets. So I don't think it's that. I think, again, the best suggestion I heard is that there's other strange things. And recently on my link page, I think it was last Sunday, I put up that astronomers are noticing these dark defects in the surface of the sun, and that might be a slight hint at what might be going on, that there's something distorting the ionization of the ionosphere that's based on some magic going on the sun. It's unfortunate that with as many years and as much interest as everyone has shown how the sun works, we know surprisingly little about it. We know the grossest of details, but the fine details we really don't know. And people are still designing models and changing them up, and we have a lot to learn about how the sun works.
And I'll Chemist Scott complained in her solar weather report that satellites called Stereo A and Stereo B are no longer looking at the back of the sun and sending her data on what's happening in the back of the sun. And they have to look at some helioscopic images. Apparently, I'm not sure what wavelength can see through the sun and sort of see what's going on the back, but it's obviously not as good. But so apparently, for the moment, until those satellites move back into position, there's less data on what's going on at the sun at a time when a lot of people want to know what's going on up there. Get it?
Well, unfortunately, these are things that often happen. When you need something the most, that's when it breaks on you or doesn't work. I know that, you know, even though you might, I can't really judge because this is my first really big sunspot cycle on 10 meters, but it is miles and miles better than it was during the summer. The summer was truly the summer doldrums. It was getting rather depressing to just chat the New Jersey DX station. That was it. Like I said, now, you know, I mean, you mentioned that you get DX, and I talk to Poland. I consider that an achievement that propagation is decent at least. So I'll take what the universe gives me. It's not like I could go to a return counter. Yeah, there's a person out there who threw out the call sign. Can you raise the amplitude of your signal? I could not make out your call sign.
K-A-T-U-T-F. You really don't know when you're at the peak of the cycle until you're past it. And even then, there can be a second peak.
Well, that was the case last time. Again, we don't really understand anything. Last cycle was biphasic. There were two. Yeah, I mean, like all things, you don't know when you've reached the peak until you go down and you stay down. So it's always things in retrospect. But it's still highly unlikely that we peak. It's probably going to happen in about a year or so if it sticks to the average thing. But like we both mentioned, last cycle, it was two peaks after each other, and the amplitudes, I don't think, got as high as the previous few. So every cycle's a new thing to study.
Roger, roger. Just an academic question, if anybody knows the answer. I always get varying responses. On how long does it take a photon to go from the center of the sun out into space, on average?
It takes a ridiculously long time. I would have to look it up because I forgot the number. But what happens is it gets reflected back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So neutrons that are emitted during fusion aren't stopped by anything. So they're almost at the speed of light. They travel right through the very core of the sun. Photons can take a terribly long time to get out past the core.
Yeah, I've heard figures from 100 to 300,000 years.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous amount of time. It's based on the fact, unfortunately, that ionized gases interact with photons, and the core is full of ionized gas. Again, the weird thing that strikes me is the neutrons that are unaffected by almost anything go straight through without slowing down, and billions of them are running through you're in my body as we speak.
Yeah, that's a roger. But what would you say is the primary mechanism that behind the ionization of the ionosphere. A photon knocks off an electron, and then they recombine somewhat later. Would you say that's a fair summary?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things. There's solar winds also that are ionized gases, and there are gamma particles. Principally, I think most of the things that really light up the ionosphere are the gamma particles that are flying away from the sun. But, yeah, those would be my two principal processes that the sun kind of lights up the ionosphere.
That's all I got.
WSUN.
Okay. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I'm going back to what Frank was talking about with the stereo satellites that were launched almost 20 years ago, I guess. But one started in the direction ahead of the Earth and the other one behind. But they're, you know, in a solar orbit. And as the years go by, they trip, one drifts further away and the other one is going in the other direction. And, you know, give it enough time, they'll crisscross and they'll actually come back. But the one of them has been out of commission for about 10 years. But we still have an active stereo spacecraft still up there looking at the sun. At least we're getting a partial view, you know, from a different angle. So that's good. And the one that went bad, something went wrong with the spacecraft. It started rotating and they lost control of it. Anyway, back to you, Russ.
AC2GS. So thank you, Paul. That's new information for me. The more information, the more research on these things, the better. And again, it's kind of surprising the lack of understanding of how the nuances and the details of how the sun functions. It's probably the most important phenomena out there. It's the power source for this entire planet. I mean, there's some nuclear decay going on at the core that produces some core heat, but otherwise, most, if not, you know, 95-98% of our energy is from the fusion reaction going on the sun. So, yeah, it'll be interesting if they discover anything new. Let me check with Frank, because I think we kind of lost Frank for a little while. Are you back, Frank?
Yeah, WB2BX. So, I had a little conflicting app on my phone. I finally moved out of the way, in addition to whatever was keeping EchoLink from keying the repeater. That's interesting. It's the solar storms and gamma ray flares and stuff. Gamma ray bursts from outside the galaxy, I doubt, are powerful enough to have an impact on the ionosphere, but like I said, not a heck of a lot is really known, which is, as you say, kind of interesting. Astronomy seems to be a field, and even solar astronomy, where almost everything is a surprise and doesn't work the way the physicists sometimes expect it to work, even though, thanks to Dr. Albert, you know, the laws that govern the universe in some respects are relatively well understood. Anyway, I'm going to be listening to WB2BX.
Okay, very good, Frank. And gamma ray bursts can really toast you. It ultimately depends upon the distance. Good old inverse square law. It's outside of the galaxy, far, far away, you know, it's not, you know, you won't get a sunburn. But God forbid, somewhere nearby in our galaxy, if it just so happens to have a gamma ray burst, and it has a very, very narrow focus also, so it's very easy to miss them. But if you're particularly unlucky, and you get a full-fledged gamma ray burst within our galaxy, it could basically toast the entire planet. Those are intense energetic phenomena.
Apparently, there's a most
unfortunately,
from what I've read, of all of them.
That happening or believed to be very slim, but yeah, I've heard that. That if one happened nearby, it would not be a good day for us. Supposedly, the largest thing that could possibly happen in our lifetime, apparently, is Betelgeuse going supernova. And they think that will not really be anytime soon. But if it does happen, it'll turn night to day. So I've read. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a flip of the coin. We don't know. It's a probabilistic situation. So, you know, it could happen in an hour from now. It could happen 200 years from now. It could happen 1,000 years from now. It's highly unlikely that it'll happen farther away in time. It seems to be rather unstable. And someone right before you came on mentioned that all gamma ray bursts are intense. I agree with you. They're all intense, but the effect on us is determined by the distance because of the inverse square law. It still follows the inverse square law. So as you double the distance, you quarter the energy intensity. If you're on the other side of the galactic cluster, it's a lot less dangerous than if it's in our galaxy. Anyway.
And you were mentioning CTC-SF allowing you to operate below the squelch level on FM and extend your range. It's very interesting because I remember almost 25 years ago when I played a little with the FM satellites, seeing that some of them were using CTCSS, and I thought that was rather silly, but that's a very good point, since satellite signals can be, since the satellites, at least at that time, were running a couple of hundred, you know, were running something on the order of milliwatts out of solar panels. So they were kind of weak, and that would kind of explain why some of the satellites were going that route, going CTCSS on the satellite downlink. I don't know if any of the newer satellites still do that. I haven't kept enough track, but I think there were a couple of amateur satellites that did that for the FM transponders. Go ahead.
Okay, I don't really know that much about those satellites. Maybe Paul, do you know anything about the mechanics of these amateur satellite systems?
I don't remember if they had tone squelch or anything like that on it. I don't know. I remember frequencies. You know, I mean, in the old days, they even had one of them on 15 meters. But as far as I can't imagine that they had tone squelches. Maybe they did. But they would want it open to everybody. So I don't see. I don't ring a bell. Back to you, Ross.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Frank, I hope you don't mind. I just want to see if John KC2SHO is still around, because I lost touch with him, and I just want to make sure we didn't drop any aspect of his question. So, John, are you still out there? Okay, I guess that answered that question, or he might have stepped away. Frank, anything else to say before we wrap this up and move on to the next thing?
Yeah, you know, if I remember correctly on the amateur satellite thing, and I may be wrong on this, we have some satellite bump on frequency. They may be able to put us straight. So putting the CTCSS, the PL tone on the downlink to make the satellite easier to hear, not necessarily requiring a tone, to transmit tone on the uplink. But the idea being that you could turn off your swell and hear the very weak low-power satellite. Anyway, that's a real, real interesting area. I actually, and then I'll let you move on, I actually did see one of the, I think they call it, what is it, one of the, I forget what mode it is called, uplink on 2 meters, downlink. I keyed the microphone button on my old KDK 2-meter FM radio and listened to my keying on my 10 or 15-meter radio. I think it was URS-12. I actually did hear my keying, but it was kind of too chirpy since FM radios are not designed to send out stable CW signals. It was kind of too chirpy to make a contact, but I actually heard my signal through it. Go ahead.
Ah, very good. That's great. Any special equipment required or just hard work?
It requires essentially no work to work a low Earth orbit satellite or work the space station. Just the patience. And these days, even a tracking website, probably you don't even need to necessarily install the software to do it. I made contact, walking out on the Brighton Beach boardwalk with a dual band HT, or actually two HTs, because you kind of have to hear yourself to know whether you're getting into the satellite, otherwise you're just kind of wasting your time. But I used to walk out on the Brighton Beach boardwalk with two HTs and make a low Earth orbit LEO satellite contact. Go ahead.
Ah, very good. Yeah, there's loads of people I talk to. We have some Kings County Radio Club members who are really into it, and they were discussing the different antennas that are available that are split Yagi design, so at 90-degree angles, one's a 2-meter, the other's a 70-centimeter, and you could do it with one handy talkie, or usually it's a little easier to do it with two handy talkies. That's the different frequencies and such. So, yeah, there's a lot of technology to play around with in this hobby.
Yeah, I think there's some other makes. Now, at the time, I bought myself one of those Arrow antennas. I just found it too awkward to try to hold two HTs and the Arrow antenna and bring it downstairs in the elevator, fighting towers. And then walk around on the boardwalk at night with this contraption. But I actually made some contacts with the rubber ducky. I even made one satellite contact through what was called the Sunset Parrot using an indoor antenna in my apartment in Brighton Beach and 20-watt radio. I actually got a confirmation. I sent it to the guy, grad student, who designed the satellite. He said it was the only confirmed East Coast contact on the single from the U.S. East Coast on the single frequency parrot, and that he knew of. What the parrot does, just briefly, a single frequency repeater. You transmit, then stop transmitting. It would retransmit you. Anyway, go ahead. I know you've been trying to get away and move on to the next person. But you'd be too yet, so.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thank you for participating tonight. Let's see. Wesley, do you want to do your topics now? I guess Wesley has stepped away from the radio. I will try one more time. And if not, then we'll move on to something else. Wesley, N2XJN, are you around? Okay, a bit of going. Let's do the TechNet puzzle. I always like to do these puzzles. There are very few of them. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is a relatively simple question. I believe that most of you people out there have a device that operates at hypersonic speeds. Would anyone like to tell me what that item is?
WA2VSM.
Yes.
Good evening. A flashlight.
Okay. Hypersonic, there's a difference between the speed of luminal and supersonic. Supersonic is nowhere near as fast as any kind of luminal speed. So we're talking about not any kind of radiation here. So I'm limiting it to non-radiative things traveling at supersonic speed.
Okay. You didn't say that, but that now, since you have clarified it, I appreciate that.
I do have an idea, but I don't think that's where you're going.
HDPL, non-ballistic devices.
I wouldn't term it a ballistic device. Again, it depends on your definition of what a ballistic device might entail. But, you know, it's something that I'm willing to bet more than 50% of you people out there listening have, probably very nearby.
Radio?
Well, unless you can fling your radio at a supersonic speed, that wouldn't qualify. No, the audio output of your radio sound is traveling at the speed of sound. It's not hypersonic. It's sonic, but, you know, it's not really, that's the wave propagation. It's not an object. It's not a thing. It's not a particle.
Wait a minute. You said supersonic and hypersonic. I believe hypersonic is more than Mach 5 or is it Mach 10?
Okay, I am misspeaking. It's supersonic. It is faster than Mach 1.
Mach 5 is hypersonic. That is right.
Yeah, well, like a military rifle is Mach 3.
Well, I don't think any of us, well, you probably have one. I don't. I was thinking of more generally available and used objects.
Animal, mineral, or vegetable?
That's an interesting thing. I would say none of the above, actually.
AZ2PO, ultrasonic cleaner.
Well, now that's an interesting thing. That's, I don't know, is it traveling faster than the speed of sound? It's high frequency, but I think it's traveling through water at a slower speed. I'm not quite sure, but I would think so.
I believe sound goes faster through water than through the air.
And the cavitation collapse is definitely ultrasonic.
Okay, well, ultrasonic isn't quite the same as supersonic, but once again, I don't think most of us have an ultrasonic cleaner. I don't have an ultrasonic cleaner. You, I'm sure, in the lab have lots of ultrasonic cleaners. So this is, again, something that's probably more than 50% of the people out there listening to me have and could scurry and get it within probably about 3-4 minutes.
Give us a hint.
Let's see. A hint that wouldn't completely give it away. It's part of a tool that we often use in playing around with little gadgets and gizmos and things.
partakers.
I didn't quite get that.
Boy, we have no takers.
No? Okay, I'll give you another one. You can hold it in your hand.
$5 bill. Goes very quickly.
I'm sure it does. Not quite this quickly, or else I'd like to hear that and see that. I'm trying to think of another hint for it. It's, that's another puzzler, finding a hint for it that doesn't just give the darn thing away. I can't say that you could buy it on Amazon, because you could buy anything on Amazon. I don't know. I'm kind of running out of hints that don't give it completely away. It weighs less than a pound usually. It's hand holdable. It is exhaustible. You use it up and you have to get a new one. How's that?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
How about a towel? If you shake a towel fast enough, the end of it would go faster than the speed of sound, maybe.
Well, you'd have to be real. I don't know, athletic, I guess. You could do that with a whip. When I tried this question out, someone said the end of a whip, because if you know how to flick a whip, you can get that snap is a supersonic phenomenon. But I've never known anyone get a snap out of a towel that way. So I'm not quite sure if you could physically snap a towel that fast.
Can break the speed of sound, Mrs. Billy. I have a question.
Sure, Ed.
Last time it was about, with a towel, you actually can do that. It takes some effort, you know, you have to work at it, but I know it can be done. You get the tip of the towel, receive the speed of sound, and make a loud snap, which is the sound of a breaking sound bath. Just the device you're mentioning, wouldn't it break the sound barrier, make a very loud bang or whatever?
Well, apparently not. It does produce something called shock diamonds, which I guess is another hint if you know what a shock diamond is.
It's going like some kind of blowtorch that the gas comes out and burns that fast.
Well, you're getting close. Yes, Jeff?
Is it one of those hand warmers where you crack the thing inside of it and it crystallizes?
No, that's not it. But Ed was getting precariously close. This object does not combust, though.
Cheese blend.
Cheese blend?
Hey, cheese blend. No, just kidding.
I had cheese blends for breakfast today, and there was nothing moved at all.
Boy, how about when you sneeze? That goes like 300 miles an hour, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, not even close.
Yeah, and I wouldn't consider that you own a sneeze. And truly, if I was talking about something that comes out of everyone's nose, I would probably say that everyone had one. But I don't think everyone has one. I'm sure there's going to be one smart aleck out there who says that they don't own this particular thing that I think most of us do.
AC to PM.
Yes, Jeff?
Soda can, when you pop it, the metal comes apart, I think, at better than 1,100 feet per second.
Okay, that's an interesting one. I don't know if it quite qualifies. I have to do further research, but that wasn't the answer I was looking for. It's a relatively simple concept. I think the problem is people just don't think of it in terms of hypersonic velocity. They use it, they see it, they do it, but they don't think of its velocity as intrinsic to what they're doing with it. Okay, well, apparently I have stumped you, so that's a success, at least in my mind. I'll give it one more try, give people a chance, and then I'll tell you what it is, and, you know, we can discuss it.
Give us a little more of a hint, Roy.
Well, let's see. I told you it weighs less than a pound. You can hold it in your hand. You use it when you're fiddling around with gadgets. It's exhaustible. It's disposable. Here's another one. A lot of people don't just have one of these things. They usually have, you know, three, four, or five of them sitting around because they use them in different places of the house, and it's relatively inexpensive. And since you empty it out and you throw it away, you have another one around. So hopefully that helps a little bit.
Is it any type of aerosol can?
Yes, it's canned air. You know that canned air that we all use? I got one about a foot away from me at this point. It operates at hypersonic speeds. It produces shock diamonds. If you do the proper photography, I'll put it up on my link page. There's a YouTube of a guy who actually set up the photography to photograph the shock diamonds being emitted out of the plastic tube of a canned air dispenser.
Okay. I'll take credit for that. W-A-2-V-M-F. Although I thought the cheese rinses sounds very good to me.
I don't know. You have evidence to support that claim?
Yeah. Like I said, I got the YouTube that shows that you can photograph shock diamonds. If there's certain type of turbulence that air undergoes. And there's a classic one that happens in jets, but also happens in the case of the tip of a canned air dispenser producing shock diamonds. So I'll put the link up on my link page. You can go to the YouTube and you can watch him kind of prove it by evidence of being able to photograph shock diamonds in the exhaust of the canned air canister.
I hear you, I understand you. I'm just having trouble wrapping my mind around it.
Okay, well, that's a kind of a good thing, because that's why when I saw this, I said, my gosh, this is a TechNet puzzle. Because I don't think anyone really thinks in terms of the speed of the canned air. They just use the canned air, and that's that. But apparently, there is a velocity-limiting effect. As you, as a given pressure of gas is thrust through a very narrow channel, it speeds up, and the limitations are in the supersonic where the shock waves develop, and that's kind of the limiting effect in aerosols like canned air. Yeah, I guess theoretically some types of spray, but you'd probably not have it work well because most sprays are not just pure gas, they're liquids, and that would probably slow the whole process down and limit the speed. But, I mean, the whole idea that I kind of picked this was that I don't think most people think in terms of the velocity of the canned air coming out. They take it sort of for granted.
Boy, is it also somewhat dependent upon the pressure, the internal pressure, pushing that air out? Because if you were to simulate it with an air hose, and you would have a nozzle at the end, if you're talking 10 pounds of air versus, say, 1,000 pounds of air, doesn't that have an effect upon the speed at which the air would be evacuated through that nozzle or through the sprayer?
Yeah, I mean, when you get to the end of the canned air, it's not traveling at those velocities anymore. But at the average pressure that a canned air canister presents to a very narrow nozzle, you have very high velocities, again, that are limited more by the turbulence than by the pressures and other factors. So that would be the case for an almost spent can of air. But if you have a certain degree, and it doesn't have to be humongous, of pressure, it's more of a function of how narrow you can make the nozzle. If you make it very, 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 very narrow, you're going to speed up any pressure other than zeros. Velocity is escaping the other end. So, in a case where the pressure is very low, you'll probably be limited by that pressure that's expanding and going out the nozzle. But in the case of canned air, you know, during the active use of the canned air, it presents with enough pressure to give you supersonic turbulence at the tube output. Yeah, Jeff, I think.
Yeah, hi, Roy. So what are these crystals? And number one, number two, is it an isenthalpic effect? And number three, does it depend on the sign of the Joule-Thomson coefficient?
Golly gosh. They're not crystals. I understand why you would think they're crystals. They're called shock diamonds because they're diamond-shaped turbulence. Again, if you take a look at the link when I post it, and you could Wikipedia it. I'll submit the Wikipedia link to shock diamonds. It's just a diamond shaped turbulence of gas traveling at supersonic speeds.
W-280.
Yes, Ed.
I have to tell you, I just can't see this. I'm not saying you can't prove it to me, but I can't accept it at face value. But here's a problem. With canned air, you're putting out a fairly large volume of air. You're blowing stuff around. It takes a fair amount of air. And I believe to get that kind of pressure, you have to have an orifice on the order of, you know, a thousandth of an inch, and then you'll never get the volume of air you want. And you'll also need pressure enough to rupture the can. So I had a real issue with this. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying I can't. I studied gas laws. I studied interior ballistics and the aforementioned military rifles, and I'm just not seeing it.
WS.
Yeah, Paul?
Yeah, the shock diamonds, you can see demonstrations with that with any rocket technology. You bring up any rocket that's been in development, you know, and you can see a demonstration of those. You know, if you look at the back of the exhaust of a proper running rocket engine and, you know, it's being tested on a test stand. And you can see the shock done, you know. And like you said before, it has to be the atmosphere. You know, any kind of air that's moving so fast, the pressure, the air pressure around it, you know, it's constraining it. But then at some point, it starts to open up a little bit. Then it goes back down again. So you'll see a series of these diamonds. You know, it really looks good. And you know, it's all jet engines or rocket engines. You can see. I haven't seen it with airflow like what you're talking about in a can. That sounds interesting. I'll have to look into that as well. Back to you.
I have another question.
Okay, what's your other question, Ed?
I know you're a doctor, but I don't think you've seen this. In military boot camp, they use these air guns for, you know, injections for vaccinations. And they actually send something into the skin. And I could see that more so